couple of years with phishing and spamming and all that kind of stuff, with the constant attacks on computer networks. Government agencies like I work for are very, very reluctant to let anybody inside their firewall. And so we had a number of very significant issues with firewalls and servers and routers and trafficking and authentication, who was coming in. And that's hard enough in the U.S. Then you go over to Britain or you go to France and it just begins to multiply. And we're still having significant issues with all of this, punching holes through firewalls, being able to get through certain ports, logging on and getting identification. And then there's other issues like, well, if you're going to archive all these files, where are they going to sit? Who's going to have those servers? Who's going to pay for that? If you're going to do authentication, well, who's going to authenticate it? Who's going to say that this is what it claims to be? And if somebody wants to go in and change something, then who's going to approve that? And we've really run into some very intractable issues of late with the whole authentication and server issue in terms of who gets in and who gets through the firewall, to what system. As I said, we have some issues with size limitation. Somebody just a few minutes ago mentioned bandwidth. Bandwidth is a very significant limitation. Our current camera is 12 megapixels. Shoots a pretty good size file. And you want to take multiple pictures and then you want to ship them, you know, back to where you are, or you want to just view those. And then finally, cost. So far, this has been way more expensive than we ever envisioned it was going to be. These instruments are running, I can't give you an actual price, but tens of thousands of dollars a piece. And now that we've actually got a couple of these things, we've begun to realize, well, gee, what if it actually works? Because if it does actually work the way we envision it work, people will want to use it. And if people want to use it, then someone's got to be there. Because even though you're working remotely from wherever you are in the world, somebody's still got to put the specimen in the microscope. And we can envision very rapidly getting to the point where we may actually be booked up all day long. And that means a staff person's got to be assigned to that. And a staff person means money and salaries and benefits. That's become, for the administrators in the agency, a real issue, because we can hardly afford to hire technicians as it is, let alone staff people to be dedicated to what is basically a service function, is the way they look at it. And the other thing that comes up as well, it's just like we have when we ship specimens around now, who do you want to be able to access this thing? Who are you going to let look at your types? And what's their credentials going to have to be? And how are they going to get permission to get in? So where to now? Well, we currently have three instruments built. One's in Paris, one's in London, and one is in Washington. But where we are really is at a bit of a standstill, because we've got some very significant issues around, as I mentioned, things like IT and staffing, but we've also got some issues with the company we've been working with, and frankly with money, because as I said, this has become a very expensive proposition. What we're trying to do is get this initial network set up to prove the feasibility and actually make sure it does work, and that we can get people onto these instruments, they can get trained fairly rapidly, and they can then prove to us that this is something that that people are going to want to use, and they won't, you know, try to get in there and start working with it, and it's going to be so difficult that they don't want to continue on. If we can get this small network functioning, then what we're going to try to do is go out and get major funding so we can actually get a big network of these things installed. This, I think, does have a great deal of potential. I think we're still a ways away yet from being where we'd like to be, even though it's been 4 years of slogging through this. But hopefully in a couple more years, I'll be able to come back and show you something that's really functioning and is a wonderful thing to use. Thanks.
Ladies and gentlemen, my name is David Ehrenholz, and I'd like to welcome you all to this symposium on photography for entomologists. I'm not an entomologist by training, I'm a surgeon, but I'm here to give you a little bit of an idea of how you can do digital photography in the field for less than $200. My objective this afternoon is to identify a cheap and small camera for many field situations, or a very compact backup camera for a more sophisticated system. explain why point-and-shoot cameras give poor results unless used with a few simple manual settings, and explain why you may not need a small camera with 10 megapixels and ISO settings to 3200, no matter what the manufacturers try and sell you. So, since I haven't had a chance to meet most of you, I want to do a survey. How many people here are really interested in doing field photography as opposed to dead specimens? Wonderful. How many currently use film SLRs? Me either. I used to. How many use digital SLRs? Okay, they're great. Wonderful quality, just big and heavy and expensive. How many would like an affordable small camera for field photography alone, or perhaps as a backup camera? I will tell you the camera I'm using is in my pocket right now. However, I have a disclaimer. I am not a professional entomologist. I have been associated with Smithsonian as a volunteer for the last 21 years, and I've been selling my photographs since I was age 14. The quality of current digital cameras is difficult to demonstrate, however, because standard projectors used for PowerPoint presentations have about 1 megapixel of resolution. So this 1 megapixel image projected looks pretty good. Worthless, by the way, if you try and make a print out of it. Compared to this photograph, which is taken from a 40-year-old Kodachrome slide I took and scanned at 20 megapixels resolution. So you're not going to get a real sense of what these cameras are capable of based on this presentation, perhaps. People ask me, what camera do you recommend? And my response is, if you own a small digital camera, see if it meets your needs by practicing the kinds of shots you will take when in the field. If it works, fine. If it doesn't, I can help. I have looked at digital cameras of every size and shape, from the huge SLRs that weigh up to 4.5 pounds, completely loaded with all the flash and massive telephoto lenses for close-up photography, all the way down to a tiny subcompact, which fits in my shirt pocket, has a 3X completely internal lens, so that when the lens extends, it doesn't shade the sun that's on the object or shade my flash, and weighs 4 ounces. Oh, and by the way, this is what it looks like. These are so small, you always have it in your pocket. My problem is I forget which pocket. The images can be framed at arm's length, literally this far away, which you cannot do with an SLR where you have to lean in, which, by the way, usually scares your subject. And the subject only sees this tiny little camera, and it's less likely to be frightened or flee if I put it up like this, take its picture, and put the camera back down. In the old days, Larry West, shown here, and John Shaw and I used to use this camera that we show you on the left. And I can tell you that after lugging that up and down hills for a couple of weeks in the tropics, it feels like you're carrying the weight of the world on your shoulders. Now, I know some of you in the audience are a lot smarter than I am, and so you have a grant, and perhaps you've used that grant money to hire an assistant. Unfortunately, I haven't. So, if you know you're only going to photograph large objects like people and landscapes, any point-and-shoot camera will get you great quality. But if you want to do insect portraits or life histories, say larvae or even eggs, and really small subjects, you need macro capabilities. How do we define macro photography? Well, for the last 40 years, 35mm film cameras have used macro lenses, which have the ability to photograph full frame a tiny object 1 inch tall or 1.5 inches wide, which is the size of a 35mm slide. That gives you a 1-to-1 reproduction ratio. Those lenses are large, heavy, and expensive. A few tiny 4-ounce digital point-and-shoot cameras can do this macro, although they do it by using a very tiny sensor. And herein lies the rub. Don't get lost on this now. This is important. Digital SLRs use large sensors, very similar to 35mm film in size. However, the tiny point-and-shoot cameras use very tiny sensors. And the problem is, it's the difference between the old large format Hasselblad camera and the tiny little Minox spy camera. And as you enlarge that image, the problem is that you tend to get a lot of blockiness. We call that pixelization. So the camera manufacturers have taken the resolution of the SLR and crammed it into ever smaller sensors. So you have an 8-megapixel sensor in an SLR, which has a field this big, or 8 megapixels into a tiny little sensor this big. And the problem is that when that happens, you get something called noise. In the old days, we called it grain in film. So do more megapixels always mean better quality? There was a time when that was literally true. When we went from 1.2 megapixel cameras to 2.5 megapixel cameras, I threw away all my 1 megapixel images. They were just garbage. But now that we've gotten up to 6 and 8 and 10 megapixels, it's hard to see, even with massive enlargement, a really big difference between a high-quality 6 megapixel image shown magnified on the right versus a 10 megapixel image from a same size imager shown on the left. That's as long as you stay at the low ISO settings. Low ISO is like using slow grain film. Some of you may remember film. More megapixels, however, causes problems when you increase the gain. You try and increase the speed of your camera so you can get pictures in lower light. And as you use higher ISO settings, the image degrades very fast in cameras with small sensors. The net result is the high-resolution camera you spent so much money for can only be used in high light levels without major quality loss. The sweet spot is around 6 or 7 megapixels for the small cameras. For the SLRs, it's probably going to be somewhere between 12 and 15 megapixels. Now, I'll give you an example, and I'm not just picking on Sony here. We get the same results using Nikon, Canon, and Olympus, you name it. I've shown you two very small cameras this size. One is a Sony T9, which is 6 megapixel, and the other is a Sony T100, which is 8 megapixel. And at ISO 80, the detail in the hair of this model is extreme.